Hello, welcome to today's teleseminar covering online advertising 2008. What works, what doesn't, and why. The research that we'll be presenting today is the result of work that went into the 2008 Online Advertising Report, Handbook, and 2008 Benchmarks. I'm Stefan Tornquist, the research director at Marketing Sherpa, and I'm joined today by Tim McAtee, senior analyst and lead author on the Online Advertising Report. Welcome, Tim.
Hi, Stefan. Thanks.
So, this is the first time that Marketing Sherpa has written a report about online advertising, and we're eager for your feedback. So, after this teleseminar, please send any comments, any questions about online advertising, things that we can focus on in coming years, because this is going to become an annual report. There's been an awful lot of interest, a lot of coverage in the press, and so that sort of confirmed one of the suspicions we had in designing this report, is that for all of the talk and the money spent on display advertising, there's a surprising lack of research. So we really wanted to answer some essential questions. Does display advertising work? That's the big one. And how does it work? If it works, you know, what is its primary function, and are we measuring it correctly? We'll be talking a lot about that later. Then how do you reduce media waste and optimize performance? Obviously, those are big questions. And finally, how do you match your online advertising strategy with your business goals? And again, we'd very much appreciate your comments as we move through this presentation, and we'll be answering some of the questions that you gave us during registration at the end. So with that, let's take a look at how the data for this study was gathered. So let's please move to slide number 2. Now here you'll see that our primary source are online display marketers themselves. We did an in-house survey of 577 folks in various appropriate Sherpa lists. We also took advantage of a late 2007 study that we conducted with attendees of AdTech, and that was 374 gave their responses. In addition to that, Tim and the analysts working with him arranged for several unique special reports coming from Mania TV, Insight Express, Unicast, and several others, as well as some eye-tracking research that I think is, having done eye-tracking for the last several years, is really some of the most interesting eye-tracking research that we've seen to date. So, with all of that out of the way, let's jump into the content for the report. So, Tim, we're now on slide 3, the big picture. Where are we headed here?
Well, Stefan, we're going to start off looking at, we are going to look at some norms of effectiveness, kind of what marketers can expect, budget levels, that sort of thing, and kind of wrap our heads around what's happening right now in the marketplace and what we can expect to be seeing in 2008 and even into 2009.
All right, so as we move to slide number 4, despite clutter, creative improving, this chart tracks some norms. Tim, what are these norms? How does an ad effectiveness study really work?
Well, anytime an ad effectiveness study is run, what they'll do is they'll simultaneously collect a control and an exposed group of respondents. And what we're looking at is the difference. So the difference is always going to be called the delta. And that difference is attributable solely to the online ad exposure because, you know, by comparing these two groups, we've taken away any variables between the two except for that ad exposure. So what we're looking at here with this chart is we're seeing that it's normal for there to be a difference for online advertising awareness of 3.6% overall. So which means that, you know, for every 100 people that come to a website on which an ad is served, 3.5 of them are going to have noticed the ad who wouldn't have otherwise. You know, and that same math holds true across the board here. So what we're seeing here, you know, among these norms is that overall advertising is doing a little bit better when we compare 2007 to the overall norms, which means that advertisers are doing a pretty decent job. We're also seeing that the majority of metrics saw increases and that lifts range from 13% for aided brand awareness to 23% lift for intent. So online ad awareness deltas and unaided brand awareness deltas did decrease a bit, which I think is the result of an increasingly cluttered online landscape, hence the title there, Despite Clutter.
All right, well, so let's move on to our next slide. And we're now on slide number 5. And here we're looking at the spending reflects the size of the target. Well, that makes sense. Do you want to talk us through this?
Sure. Again, I mean, this is, I think, just something that makes sense at a pretty basic level here. Just the more people you have that you're advertising to, the more you're going to wind up spending. So I think this is a good place for advertisers to just get a bearing on, you know, based on where they are in you know, with their own targets, where they should be spending. And I think it's really interesting to see that there is a pretty huge range there, that, you know, someone with a huge mass audience, you've got everything from, you know, from 10K to 99K, all the way up to 1,000,000+. Granted, you know, they're more likely to spend more, again, because they do have the bigger targets. So I think one of the interesting things here too is just with general B2B, you do see that sort of sweet spot of 100K to you know, to just under 1,000,000, which again I think just speaks a lot to just prices right now and how big the target is, and makes quite a bit of sense.
All right, so let me play devil's advocate for a second. For companies that are spending smaller amounts on display, is it really practical to do the kinds of brand awareness and you know, these fairly long-term tests to really track the ROI of online marketing? So does it make sense, if I'm a smaller B2B advertiser, I've probably bought display ads on the same sites that I used to, the same publishers where I was used to be a print advertiser or still a print advertiser. If I'm spending less than 50K online, does it make sense to engage in these kinds of tests, or are there other kinds of tests that make more sense for the smaller budget online advertiser?
Well, I think we have to differentiate between small targets and small budgets. Whether you have a huge target or, I mean, it's very possible to have a huge target and a small budget, or a small target and a, you know, and a huge budget. And it really just depends on, you know, what your profit margin is and what it takes to get a decent ROI. So, you know, if you do have a huge target, but you have, you know, really slim margins, you know, then maybe it doesn't make a ton of sense to spend a lot of money. You know, alternatively, if, you know, you're selling nuclear reactors or something like GE, you know, you can have a huge cost per ad, you know, a huge cost per sale, and have that still make sense. So it really does sort of depend on your margins and you know, just getting the right message in front of the right people.
So the implication there, that there's a lot here that that talks to media modeling as well, right? If
sure.
if you are in a position where maybe brand effectiveness studies aren't the optimal measure, you can base your investments on a media model. And we get questions about this very often. There are specific agencies that do media modeling. Is there a good reason to go beyond your regular agency to look at those specialists?
Well, again, I mean, anytime you're testing or modeling, I mean, when you're modeling, you're sort of taking a leap of faith. And the better your model, the more likely you are to spend your money wisely, you know, once you spend it. When you're testing, there's always going to be a bit of an opportunity cost. You know, one way that, you know, with an ad effectiveness study, again, there's always going to be your control audience. So if your target is CEOs who, you know, sell a certain product or create a certain product, you know, and it's very, very small, very limited, having, you know, half of your target audience go dark, what you test half the CEOs versus the other half the CEOs to see who spends more is kind of idiotic, frankly, just because your opportunity cost just doesn't make sense. If, however, you know, you're selling gum to the Chinese, you know, suddenly it's very easy to sort of black out 1,000,000 people and see what that difference is in real time and test that. If you find yourself in the situation where the opportunity cost is just too great to ignore, then modeling is absolutely the way to go. And You know, you with anything, you get what you pay for. So if you go to a company that specializes in modeling, I think you are going to get what you pay for, and in the end, you know, save a lot of money doing it that way.
All right, well, let's turn to our next slide. We're now on slide number 6 of the presentation. Agencies get results at a price. So this brings up a really, what's a very hot question, or been a hot question for the last 15 years as online forms have become more and more important in marketing plans, which is, are all agencies created equal? Do full service agencies, are they able to really optimize online campaigns? Tim, why don't you talk us through this slide?
Sure. What we're looking at here is just from left to right, you know, absolutely worth the money, good results but too expensive, average results but cheap, and then all the way on the far right, poor results and expensive. So we're seeing a pretty massive variance, but it seems like just in terms of who's absolutely worth the money, search marketing agencies and analytics consultants, and even online boutique agencies got the best scores there. Full service agencies, interestingly, got, you know, 55% of respondents who use a full service agency saying good results but far too expensive. Media agency, kind of, you know, half and half there. You know, a lot of people thought they were expensive. 20% said poor results and expensive. So sort of the worst of the bunch here. And then I think what's really interesting is we're looking at analytics consultants. There's no middle ground there. It's either, you know, all the way on the left, absolutely worth the money, or all the way on the right with poor results and expensive. And I think what that says is, you know, for the same reason that hiring a personal trainer doesn't actually make you lose weight, simply employing an analytics consultant isn't enough to do the trick. Implementing changes in analytics is a major commitment that no consultant can do for you. So if you do it right, you know, you get this huge payoff. It's great. But if you just sort of are looking for a quick fix, you know, you're just wasting your money, basically. So, I don't know, just interesting results there.
All right, well, let's move on and take a look at some of the lessons learned from the different creative tests. Let's move beyond slide 7 into slide 8 and take a look at how these studies were conducted.
Yeah, from the, you know, macro of those last few slides down to the incredible micro of this stuff here. I think it's really interesting here that we look at, and this is from a study by Inside Express, comparing a Volvo ad and a Mitsubishi ad, where what they did in the first one there is a pretty simple thing. And I don't know if you can even see it on that slide, but in the top right corner, they added a little Volvo logo. And just that little tiny logo resulted in an 86% increase in brand recognition among people who saw those ads, control versus exposed, you know, or control versus test, I guess. And then with the second one there, with the Mitsubishi ad, what they did was they kept that, you know, Mitsubishi logo in every other frame along with the name, and then interspersed it in between the other sort of, you know, the creative messaging, so that it was really obvious who did the ad. And with that one, you saw a 219% increase in you know, brand recognition. So really what that says is a couple things. It says that, you know, there's a lot of things on the screen that are competing for the attention of your viewers, and you only have just a very brief moment to get their attention and to, you know, show your message and say what you have to say. And the other thing is just that, you know, with frequency, with repetition, that really does help drive home points that you're trying to get across. So you do want to make sure that, you know, at any point during the time that they're on a page, they see what you want them to see, and that when they do, you know, you hammer it home, I guess.
Well, that's very interesting. The point that something so small as the inclusion of a logo, you know, with all of the time that we spend thinking about the creative for a campaign, you know, you think about some of the more sophisticated rich media campaigns, an awful lot of thought and money goes into the design and, of course, to the media buy. And yet something so small as the inclusion of a logo from the first frame through the end can have a dramatic difference. So, you know, there's a very practical lesson that that we can all take away. Let's move on to the next slide. We're now on slide number 9 of the presentation. And I've got to say, this example from Celebrex brings back a lot of memories, because in a prior life, I started a rich media company. And our premise at the time was that why try to take people off the page they're surfing when rich media can allow them to experience essentially an entire landing page on the page. Now, this is back 10 years ago, and that same question is still there, and it's underlined by the same basic issue, which is that click-through rates are extremely low. So perhaps in the course of talking to this slide, Tim, you can address the question of, should we even be looking at online ad click-through rates?
Well, you know, I'm guessing that back when, you know, you were working there, you know, click-through rates were still probably 5%.
Well, pretty close to it.
Yeah, of course. Was it 75?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Starsky and Hutch was number one on the charts. Uh-huh. Well, what was interesting, though, was in a very short period of time, click-through rates went from 5% down to 3%, down to 2%, and then the internet bust happened. And now at this point, where are we?
Yeah, well, now we're at a 0.25 average click-through rate. So, what is it, like 1 in every 1,000, 4,000? I don't know. Math, never my strong suit.
That's good to know.
The thing is that there are so few people that click, and, you know, as we saw in some of the other studies, the people who do click, it's funny, there's actually, you know, the 80-20 rule kind of applies to clickers, where 20% of the online audience makes like 80% of the clicks. I don't know who these people are, but they like to click.
I'm pretty sure they're the ones keeping spam alive.
Yeah, I think so. The point is, I guess, that people are just so burnt out by clicking that it really has become, if at best, a secondary objective for advertising. The thing that, you know, if you're going to be doing display advertising, you should be focusing on branding. And these types of ads where they take a lot of data that would have otherwise been buried and never seen, and you bring that up, and you make it easy for someone to educate themselves. And once someone has sort of a baseline level of understanding, they are going to be a lot more likely to click or to give you their email address or to, you know, sort of further that conversation. But, you know, in much the same way that, you know, when you meet a stranger, there has to be some sort of pleasantry involved before, you know, you become friends. There's got to be this kind of this middle ground here, and I think a lot of these rollover expandable ads do a pretty good job of getting a lot of information out there that would have otherwise been hidden.
Definitely. All right, well, let's go on to our next slide, slide number 10 of the presentation. Video works better at communicating, and so as I look across these different ad types and the percentage of people who understood the message, it doesn't seem like the difference between in-page video and a GIF. I mean, there's certainly a difference there. It's a significant difference. But it doesn't necessarily justify the cost would be one question. But at the same time, I can only suspect that the kind of message that can be communicated by video and very quickly communicated is much more sophisticated than what a GIF can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is just, you know, demonstrating quantitatively what happens when you kind of pack more communicative power into an ad unit. And it really does make a difference in how much information people soak up from your ad.
Well, and the number of messages that can be contained in a very short period of time. A GIF can get across that a new Toyota is available, perhaps, or get across that it's on sale. It becomes more and more difficult in a static image to convey both of those things, let alone any of the sort of the sexier brand affiliation that video can communicate.
Right. I mean, and you see that. I mean, part of why TV advertising does so well is not because it's on a TV, you know, it's because it's video. And there's absolutely no reason why, if you have, you know, a relatively captive audience, such as someone who's waiting for, you know, some in-stream entertainment to load, I mean, they're basically engaged in the exact same action that they would be on a television. The only difference really is just, I don't know, just there's really not a ton of difference.
Well, if there's a difference, it's probably to the advantage of the online medium, at least at the moment, because they're sitting in front of a,
right,
a desktop with fewer distractions than they have on TV, perhaps. And, you know, we'll probably see over time the interaction rates and effectiveness rates of things online, in terms of online video, we'll probably see those things back off, like
Absolutely.
We saw the banner ad. But I mean, right now you can see that, based on where larger branding-oriented companies are putting their money, that in-stream video, desktop video, is of a very high degree of interest to all of these guys.
Yeah, and I'll leave it at that. But I will just say that my money's on streaming video, and I think there's going to be a huge future there for ad-supported content.
All right, well, let's take a look at the next section, targeting ROI, and here we're getting into media buying and analytics.
Okay, if you move on to slide 12, what we're seeing here is that online advertising is getting more effective thanks to better targeting. So, according to this chart, advertisers rate the ability to use behavioral and contextual targeting as the best ways to achieve great ROI. Inside Express also cites targeting as a key driver of effectiveness in their studies that they've run. And the nature of targeting itself is rapidly changing as technology enables real-time logic when deciding when an ad is served, which ad to serve to specific people. And the reach of large ad serving and publisher networks allows for niche audiences to be pulled from the crowd and treated differently. So for advertisers seeking tiny vertical niche sites, services like Comscore, Nielsen, or Quantcast allows marketers to quickly and easily find obscure targets. And the key takeaway for advertisers is that the context in which an ad is served is as important as the ad itself. So think about direct marketing in the traditional world. The list is the most important variable in success. If the consumer is not in the proper state of mind, or simply does not fall into the group of people who would ever have a reason to consider a product, then the impression is wasted. From an ROI perspective, eliminating wasted impressions, then making a good impression by serving up great advertising is consistently the best option for advertisers.
Well, that makes sense. And one other note on this, you may look down and see that rich media ads don't seem to stack up all that well in comparison with some of the other tactics. But I would almost say that this is an apples to oranges comparison, because I think the potential for rich media ads are the means, not the end, whereas the targeting mechanisms are sort of the end, and it's when you put rich media in cooperation with sophisticated targeting that it's really going to be its most powerful, like anything else.
Absolutely.
All right, well, let's turn to slide number 13 in the presentation and take a look at the various tests that you looked at. It appears that the qualitative tests, those tests that gather the opinions of people, were those that had the highest impact on ROI, which to those of us in the direct world seems a little counterintuitive, perhaps.
I mean, maybe this is a bit of a personal bias that I've had for a long time, but I have always thought that great advertising is always more important than all the analytics and all that stuff. If you don't connect with people, you know, in the end, it's about people. You kind of lose the point. So, and I just found it really fascinating that when we actually went out and asked advertisers, you know, what among these tests has the best impact on your you know, return on investment, that it was these qualitative tests. So, again, I mean, it just really speaks to the fact that you have to go out and you have to really understand your consumer and, you know, stop basically spamming them with kind of bad advertising.
All right. Well, fair enough. Let's move on to the next slide. We're now on slide number 14. And this is the eye tracking study that we mentioned earlier in the broadcast. You'll notice the heat map, or one of the heat maps from which this data was drawn, But this chart, this dinosaur's tail, what are we seeing here?
Okay, this is kind of a funky chart, but let me walk you through this. If you look at along the bottom of the chart, you're going to see right block ad one, partner center right, right block ad two, partner center left. And then, so on the left, you've got one ad that's above the fold there, and then the rest of those kind of trail down along this long page below the fold. Now, the top line here represents all of the ads that were ever visible among all the people that we showed this page to for the eye tracking study. So basically, what happened was 100% of the people saw that ad above the fold because, you know, 100% of the people looked at the page. And then the farther down you go, the more people drop off because they never quite scrolled that far. So the ad itself never even appeared on the page. And yet, you know, I mean, the way that ads are counted right now, when people buy impressions, all those ads would have been, you know, bought impressions. Somebody bought those ads, even though they never made it in front of human eyes. So, I mean, right there, that's just something you've really got to be paying attention to if you're a media buyer. It's just where on the page your ad is actually being shown, because you're lopping off a big chunk of your views. So the bottom line there is the percent seen. So what this represents is the percent of people who actually saw the ad, looked at it. And, you know, one of the kind of really interesting things is that column one, ad two, kind of all the way, you know, two thirds of the way down, that ad actually did a lot better than some of the bigger ads that were farther up, simply because of where it was on the page. So if you're kind of evaluating, you know, the eye flow of how somebody consumes the content on the page, what's happening is, you know, the track that somebody follows with their eyes doesn't necessarily have much to do with, you know, kind of a steady consumption of content, you know, left, right, down, you know, straight down the page. Like, it really does sort of, you know, skip around. And so the big takeaways here is that it's really important to make sure that, you know, when you're considering placements, that you are looking for placements that sort of naturally fall within your eye flow. And that on top of that, that you are, you know, factoring in kind of what the actual effective viewing of your ads are, as opposed to the bought number.
So that might potentially be a point of negotiation in the media buying process.
Yeah, absolutely. And on the other side, I mean, I think for publishers who want to switch to, you know, kind of a more linear sort of streaming format, you know, such as video or Ajax or something, where basically instead of having a huge long page that you scroll, you simply have a much shorter page that you're kind of going deeper into in one place. You know, I mean, that right there, that's, you know, another argument for testing that to see if fewer ads can actually be worth more money because they get more eyeballs.
Interesting. All right, well, let's move on to slide number 15 in our presentation. And, well, no surprise here, frequency is a key factor, but maybe the degree of difference is what's surprising.
Yeah, yeah. This was a study done by Inside Express, where they split up versus two different exposed groups. One was just everybody, so that's the 5.4 and 6.5% delta. And then on the right, you've got, you know, 29.3 and 20.8% as your deltas. And that's just among people who are exposed four more times to the ad. So what this is saying is that it's not necessarily saying that you need to go out there and put a million ads in front of everybody. What it's saying is that you really need to be aware of how many ads people are seeing. If you're looking at advertisers who are doing direct response, what they find is that the most efficient frequency is often lower. If you're looking at brand familiarity metrics, it does cap out after a certain time, because, you know, at some point you become familiar. I mean, there's kind of nowhere to go from there. So the point is that if you're going to be advertising, you need to be frequency capping. You need to be paying attention to sort of where your frequency is going and you know, make sure that it is optimized for your audience.
All right, let's go on to slide number 16 and take a look. Here's an example of a very intelligent piece of behavioral targeting. I believe this was served to you personally, wasn't it,
yes,
Tim?
Yes, yes, me and me alone. Cookied my computer.
Well, and obviously with good effect. So day of the week, parting for response. Obviously, this is something where time and geography need to work hand in hand. And one of my first questions would be, is geotargeting now at a point where the fact that, I mean, in the old days, 30% of the population lived in Reston, Virginia because AOL was there. We've moved to a point where geotargeting is fairly effective.
Yes and no. Geotargeting is definitely, you know, technologically a lot better than it used to be. The success rate for actually, you know, finding and figuring out where people are is pretty high. I mean, I don't have the exact number, but I want to say it's in the you know, 80-90% range in terms of accuracy. So you are still going to get instances where, you know, your ISP is based out of Saskatchewan or something and you're in Miami. But for the most part, that's not going to happen. And especially, you know, if you are very purposely choosing to advertise on a site, like a, you know, a digital city or a Metro Mix or something where, you know, it is sort of location based and you know where these people are, in the country. So it isn't that hard to, you know, serve an ad like this, like on a Metro Mix at, you know, what, 7 hours till the weekend. Let me do the math. Is that 9 a.m.? Are they advertising
so that
at 9 a.m.?
That would be 2 in the afternoon on a Wednesday.
So the point being that, you know, you can definitely do this. The question, I think, more so is why and when would you do this? And if you look at the graph on the right, what that does is it actually breaks out by day overall, and not just for beer. These are kind of unrelated here, but just overall, according to advertising.com, when people click on an ad, which is in blue, versus when people convert, which is in beige there. And what we see is that you've definitely got, you know, people sort of like allow for their curiosity to get the better of them on Saturdays and Sundays and are a lot more likely to click, you know. It is kind of a weird phenomenon there. And then during the week, you know, when it's sort of more about business, you see that spike kind of, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of, that's the, you know, the getting stuff done time. So that's when people actually go out and, you know, shop during their lunch break from work. And you know, that's sort of when you're going to see the conversion happening. So it is important to remember, especially, you know, for e-commerce people or somebody who is relying on something beyond a brand action, to think about sort of what the mindset of these people is. So maybe, you know, you spend sort of Monday through Friday putting out, you know, branding advertising saying, you know, just how great your brand is, and then Saturday and Sunday is when you hammer home the, you know, the click now 20% off sort of discount thing.
Interesting. So let's move on to our next slide, 17 in the deck. And the chart that we're looking at here, analytics entering the modern age, this is of people who are conducting analytics. This is not a look at the whole universe, right?
Right. So, yeah, just to break that out, I mean, there are a lot of people out there who aren't doing any analytics at all. We did not factor that in. So, but basically just, you know, breaking out kind of how people are doing analytics here, it's interesting to see that, you know, you get this nice bell curve of non-existent to completely automated, but that the majority of people are right there in the middle. And it's pretty cool to see that you've got 27.8% who are in the mostly automated but not yet integrated across all marketing vehicles category. I don't know. I mean, as an ex-analytics person myself, you know, that I'm actually surprised it's as high as it was.
I was as well. And that's very good news because certainly so many companies have spent money on analytics without having without investing in proper support of it, and without automating processes, which is really something that you've absolutely got to do. It's very easy for a marketing department to get overwhelmed by numbers, and especially when you need to get buy-in from folks higher in the organization. If you don't have a certain degree of automation grabbing those sort of C-level eyeballs on a regular basis, it becomes more and more difficult over time to make that argument for subsequent investment. Okay, let's go on to slide number 18. And this is essentially a look at what happens after we view ads, right?
Yeah, I mean, one of the most important takeaways for any online marketer is that just because it's hard to track the effect of an ad doesn't mean the ad wasn't effective. So ad effectiveness studies use surveys to help paint a fuller picture of the true effect of online advertising, but it's up to analytics departments to figure out how to integrate direct response, tracked metrics, which, you know, as we saw from the last slide, we're sort of just getting good at, with these indirect response or branding metrics. So only then can online advertising really demonstrate its true worth. So as the data on this slide illustrates, consumers are far more likely to notice an ad and consider a later visit than they are to click on it immediately. So, I mean, let's look at the numbers here. 36% say that they often will do further research as a result of seeing or hearing an ad. I believe that. I mean, I think, you know, in my own experience as a consumer, you know, I definitely fall into line with this where, you know, frankly, I would never click on an ad. But if I notice an ad, I will absolutely follow up via search, you know, ask a friend, that sort of thing. How about you?
Well, that's exactly right. Now, you know, we've heard from and seen in a number of studies that you spend a lot of money on display advertising, you see a bump in search, you see a bump in email subscriptions. There are those effects, but they're further downstream. They're not coming from the click. Okay, well, let's take a look at the next couple of slides, and then we're going to go to your questions. On slide number 19, we wanted to thank you all for your attendance by offering a $100 discount on the Online Advertising Handbook with 2008 benchmarks. But to get that discount, make sure you use the URL within this slide. On slide number 20, here's a quick description on the Landing Page Optimization Summit taking place in Florida on June 2nd and 3rd. As any Sherpa reader knows, landing pages are the fastest and least expensive way to increase your sales. Optimization of landing pages is the entire topic of this intensive course. You'll come out of that not just with a certification in landing page analysis, but also some very practical next steps on your landing pages. So I encourage you to join us in Florida there. All right, let's take a few minutes and answer some questions from the audience. First up, how do you increase conversion rates and drive the average revenue per user online?
Well, the biggest way to do that is by decreasing media waste. I think we're all familiar with, was it John Wanamaker's statement that half my advertising is wasted? I don't know which half. And of course, you know, online's supposed to fix that. And, you know, in a way, I mean, you don't necessarily know which half of your advertising is wasted or kind of it's harder to quantify than I think the initial promise was, but it's a whole lot easier to target than it used to be. And you know, frankly, if you're not targeting at this point, like you're missing out. There's definitely room for that. The other thing I think is just, you know, doing stuff like your landing page design and you know, upsell. And there's a lot of things that you can do. Just talking to kind of lifetime sales per customers, and you know, really treating conversion as more of a, you know, lifetime relationship instead of just sort of one time shot.
Fair enough. All right. Here's a good one. How effective and relevant is online advertising to target the C-level audience for B2B services? The question here is about B2B services, management consulting, and so forth. But obviously the question can be extended to how good is online advertising for targeting anyone at the C-level or any other niche?
Okay. I mean, advertising is just as effective among a C-level audience, assuming that it's good and it resonates and speaks to them, as it is for any other audience. I mean, just because they're a CEO doesn't mean they're immune to being swayed by your messaging. The hard part is going to be targeting advertising to them with a minimum of wasted impressions. So, you know, that's where things like newsletters and social networks and data matching and other advanced forms of targeting come in. You know, I mean, I have to imagine that somewhere out there is, you know, the CEO Facebook club or something where you can go and you know, literally just advertise to CEOs. And, you know, all facetiousness aside, like, it is definitely possible if you do your homework to get in front of these people. And yes, it might be a, you know, $70 CPM, but if you're selling nuclear reactors, then it's probably worth it.
Good answer. All right, our last question is, what is the best measure of the effectiveness of online advertising, and what's the best way to prove ROI? Well, I sort of picked this one because it's a softball, but it really emphasizes a point that underscores this whole presentation.
Well, I mean, I think the best measure is, are you making money? You know, tests like matched market tests are one way to objectively look at the effects of advertising, but, you know, there's the opportunity cost to do so. Ad effectiveness studies, also, you know, it's a good way to evaluate by looking at proxy metrics such as brand favorability in a control versus exposed audience without incurring too much opportunity cost. But it's really important to differentiate between your return on objective and your return on investment when you're dealing with proxy metrics. Just because you're increasing your brand favorability by, you know, 10%, you know, what does that really mean for your ROI? And you know, to some extent, it's you just kind of have to take these things on faith. You know, you have to believe that if, you know, 10,000 more people know about your product, that, you know, X percent of those people are going to be more likely to buy it, you know, and do that math and figure out, you know, is it worth it on a per user basis? And, you know, when is it good enough? When, you know, when do you know sort of when to quit? I'm not sure there is a good enough. I mean, that's what we do as marketers. You know, we're always trying to improve and sort of beat our old scores.
Well, I think that's a great point on which to end our presentation today. Thank you all very much for attending. And Tim, thanks for your insights.